thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
There we go.
Here's John Williams.
Yeah, we got big thoughts for you, and only 2 hours to think them. We're here until 3 o'clock, after which time I'll stop thinking big thoughts and go back to being a man who is trying to move from one location to another. I bored you at great length yesterday with my tales of woe about moving from Minneapolis back to Chicago. Today, a fun thing happened. We did our final, we closed on the new condo that we bought up by Wrigley. So that's
Congrats,
kind of fun.
That's exciting.
Really exciting, but nothing has changed in that I literally probably signed 75 to 100 pages. I could not tell you what one of them meant.
I know. My husband's a lawyer, so I always defer to him, which is really wrong.
And everybody in that room knew what was going on, but me, maybe me and Brenda. I'm not sure that Brenda was as clear on it as everybody else was, but I guarantee you, I didn't know what these people handing me the papers knew. And it's just a matter of trust. Do you trust the attorney and the real estate agent and the lending guy? David Hochberg was in the room. So it was, you know, just like, okay, this document 4273B means that if the city does an inspection and then the taxes, then the real estate, and then it comes into arrears, and then that means that that's credited for the next fiscal year. I go, yes, okay, where?
And doesn't your head just want to explode?
Yeah, and you know, and we did that for about an hour and a half, and that was quick. And but at the end of the thing, they give you the keys, and they're nice people, so some of them give you a bottle of champagne. And then you give them $15,000 for that service, and then you drive away and you get your new place. And there's always a few fees on those things that you don't really fully understand or anticipate, and you think, I could get a further explanation of the taxes on the garage, which I didn't know I had to pay and are separate from the taxes on the unit. But
is that because it's a separate structure?
Well, it's all in the same building.
Oh.
And I didn't know about this. They said, yeah, we have to pay taxes on the garage. I go, well, okay, fine. And so I'm signing away thinking, but I want to know, why do I have to pay taxes on the garage? And then they would say some stuff, and I would say some stuff, and then I'd go, huh. And then I would pay taxes on the garage. I chose to cut to the chase. Just sign and pay taxes on the garage. So I don't have to pay taxes on the garage. And then they say, this is the city stamp. This sort of signifies that you've gone from them to you. I said, well, I already pay property taxes, and I already signed the mortgage, and yeah, but the city needs to put a seal of approval on it. Like, okay, now we got it. It's your place. Okay, how much will that cost? $3,200. Okay.
What?
So there's, I don't even know what that is, but there's a thing, and the city got about $3,000. Okay, fine. And it just goes on like that. It just goes on like that. And they were all really nice people, and I think I was dealt fair and square, but it's just sort of like, the less I know, almost the better. Think about that. When we go up to the place, we go up Lakeshore Drive. And as you go up Lakeshore Drive, you know, you go past all of the exits off of Lakeshore Drive. And a couple of them have been on my mind lately because I've been going to them so far, by them so frequently, either to get to my new place or my son's places. They live north of the radio station, so I'll go up Lakeshore Drive. I'm thinking about Lawrence and Wilson. I take Wilson a lot. And when I take the Wilson exit off of Lakeshore Drive, you know, you exit to the right and then you come back and you go underneath. Now, the city is going to have to do some bridge work, some bridge repair on the Lawrence and Wilson overpasses. And Mark Brown wrote about this in the Chicago Sun-Crimes today. He said, okay, the problem with this project is that there are people living in little ad hoc tent cities under Lakeshore Drive. As you go north and south on LSD, know that when you go over at least those two, you're going by little communities which have sprung up. And it's not just guys with cardboard boxes and sad sleeping bags like you'd see, say, on Lower Wacker Drive, but there are nicely pitched tents there.
We had one right across the street from our parking lot a few months ago.
Oh, here at Tribune Tower?
Yes.
Where was that?
It was literally across the street from the parking lot. You know, kind of, well, if you just are standing in our parking lot on Lower Illinois.
Yeah.
They had tents. They had mattresses.
Really?
They had a little city going there.
Yeah.
And I actually called about it. And because I wanted to interview some of the people over there and just find out about their life and why they were there and got turned down by the homeless people, but after I made a phone call about 3 weeks later, it was no longer there.
You think you inadvertently outed them or
maybe
got them moved?
Maybe.
Well, that's the problem. So you have this homeless community, which is chosen let's go back to Lakeshore Drive, chosen some of the underpasses, some of the viaducts there as a place to live. If you want to go on foot from west of Lakeshore Drive to the lake, you might want to walk along underneath there. They've got a pretty wide sidewalk there, enough room for the tents to go up. The problem is when you do, you are walking through a kind of dark viaduct with tents and food and debris. But it is, I mean, it's not just a random guy. They're permanent, they're tents set up there. They're there every day. They live there. They live there. And you have to walk by, through, or around that to get to the lake. And the city's going to do this bridge work. And so now there's an issue about what do we do with these people? Shouldn't we give them notice? Do we have the right to just pick them up and move them out of the way? And isn't that inconsiderate? Because, frankly, we've got to find a place for these people. And that you're pushing them out doesn't solve the problem now, does it? And that's sort of the tone of Mark Brown's piece, or the tone of advocates for the homeless. And I got to tell you, I don't get that. I'm amazed that the city allows for these tent cities to sort of pop up at places that the rest of the city might want to use and might now feel intimidated using because these people are there. I don't know if they're violent. I don't know if they're sober. I don't know if they're any more violent or sober than I am. I don't know anything about them except that there's a homeless tent city underneath the Lakeshore Drive at these two locations, at Lawrence and Wilson, and again, at other places as well. But, I mean, there are lines in Brown's piece. He quotes Mark Sarlis, who currently lives in a tent under the Wilson Viaduct and has helped to try to organize his fellow tent dwellers. He said, "We're trying to get them to house these people instead of just tossing them out. In fact, they say that they should have priority on the city's homeless list." I guess there's a list, and if you get on it, eventually they'll try and help you find some housing. They said, "Well, if you're just going to evict us from where we're living under Lakeshore Drive, then we should cut to the top of the list because this is an extraordinary circumstance. We've got a place to live, and now you're kicking us out." And I keep thinking, no, you don't have a place to live. A place to live is a place that, to be honest with you, you either own or you're paying the rent on. That's where you live. If not, then you don't have any right or claim to that. Doesn't sound like I sympathize much with the people in this plight, does it? That's not my point. I do. But I don't think they get to claim that space as their own. They don't. I mean, I guess it would be nice to give them some sort of fair warning or notice. Sure it would. And we should try and find a place to house them and give them services and rehabilitate them, all of that. But they don't have squatters' rights. It's not public first come, first serve. I'm very much amazed that they're there. And then the sort of righteousness that Brown is writing with, and I like Mark. He's been on our show. I think he and I are different places on this. In fact, he says this: "The encampments have sparked considerable debate in the Uptown neighborhood between nearby residents who complain the encampments make it unsafe to reach the lakefront and others who argue that they aren't hurting anyone and should be left alone. I'm in the latter camp," he writes. "As I've explained in the past, the location is attractive to homeless people because it's relatively safe, it's near services, near a neighborhood, the Good Samaritans are able to drop off food and clothing, so it's a good place for them to live. But it's also a good place for me to be able to walk to the lake or ride my bike to the lake. And they're not in the way, that is, they're not blocking that path, but they're blocking a lot of the path, and they're making it feel dangerous to the people that want to use it. And the city just pretends that's not happening. So now when the city's going to repair the bridges, they say, okay, you better fix this, city. This is on you. And I'm thinking, no, it's not on the city. It's on you. You have no right to be there to begin with. I don't know what
you're... But they're just going to go somewhere else, John. So, I mean, it is a problem for the city because they have to help. They have to do something about it. And many of it, it's such a catch-22 because many of these homeless people refuse to go to shelters. They refuse to go inside. They want to stay outside for various reasons. So it's a vicious cycle.
I totally agree with that. And I think that is a different conversation. It's one I am avoiding here. Because I don't know what the solution is, and I don't think
there is one.
And I also don't know where they should go or should be allowed to go. But I do know where they shouldn't be allowed to go, And I don't think that is clogging up the viaducts or the underpasses for people. That's, to me, that's just not an option.
Well, and then you have this other argument. Are they allowed to be on Michigan Avenue begging for money all up and down this beautiful tourist area?
Yeah, I know. I feel for that, too. And I see so much of that. And it's, and there's every stripe of panhandling that takes place in Chicago, right? You've got the Bucca Boys here. You've got the people that are doing various sorts of musical acts. I don't think buskers
okay, they're
are the
working.
Same. Yeah, I know. That's right. I think buskers are working, and they're not just – I don't even know where you would put the Bucca Boys, but the kids that are pounding away on old milk barrels are providing some sort of entertainment, and you can tip them or not if you don't want. Then there's the people that are offering to shine your shoes. I guess that's working for a living. But there's a fine line between offering a service or an entertainment – and harassing somebody until they finally, in order to keep you from harassing them, fork over $5. And on it goes. There was some people now who just make the little cardboard signs, and they sit there with their head down all day long on Michigan Avenue near some very trendy spots. I get my donuts for Saturday morning and coffee for the crew here, and there are the regulars there every single Saturday morning. I mean, they've camped out those spots. Heck, if you take the exit ramp on a lot of highways, some people have a greater commitment to work a certain exit than other people have to doing the jobs they do and pay taxes for, you know? I mean, it's like some of these people, they could have a job because they're demonstrating the sort of commitment to their trade that you would ask somebody to demonstrate.
Correct, but the
job.
Lifestyle that they may lead may not be able to allow them to have a quote-unquote real job, I guess.
Yeah, I think as I'm arguing it, I'm making it sound a lot easier than it is to say, oh, well, then go work at McDonald's or go work at Walmart or go work at WGN. It's 121. Okay, but back to the viaduct. What's your take on that? Does the city have some sort of obligation to find housing for these people? Or since they don't own that spot and they're just squatting, should the city not worry too much about that with or without the bridge work? You've seen this. What's your thought about it? 312-981-7200. Here we go. This is WGN. I'm talking about Mark Brown's piece, page 2, Sun-Times today. What do we do with the people that live in the viaducts under Lakeshore Drive at Lawrence and Wilson? And I think we need to do something, but just letting them live there I don't think is fair to anybody. That is not the solution. So we'll start with Tony. Jump on there, Tony. You're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, John. I love your show. Listen, I'm down at Montrose Beach every weekend, year-round. My take on it is the city's kind of dropped the ball on this. They should have moved these people out when they started to move in. These people just wander around. I've go through the bird sanctuary. I see them defecating in the bird sanctuary over there on the east side of Montrose. There's no porta potties. Then to compound this, I see activists showing up there on my way out, setting up tables, putting out food spreads for them, which basically it's like feeding the pigeons. You're encouraging them to stay. So I think the city's really dropped the ball on this, and they need to go. They don't pay property taxes, and they have lakefront property.
It's not like feeding the pigeons, Tony. You need to take that back.
Well, people show up there with food and are constantly feeding them, so it's not really motivating them to do anything with their lives except just hang out down there.
Yeah, and see, I agree. I'm all for rehabilitation. I'm all for services. I can be very socialist about this sort of thing. I want to help them. I don't want to help them there. That's the point, right, Tony? Thanks for the call. From you to Paul, you're on WGN. Hey, Paul.
Hey, John. Welcome back. I missed you.
Hey, thank you.
So I'm a private investigator, and I work for a private investigation firm. It'd be great if you got an attorney on one of these days that does eviction processes. But a lot of these people, just like your last caller said, they build up in these locations, whether it be buildings or whether it be under bridges. And then they start making structures underneath these bridges.
Yeah.
Guess what? Now they're claiming squatters' rights. And it's a very fine line. Because you're thinking squatters' rights, no, that belongs to the city, or that belongs to whoever owns that property. Well, guess what? If it's not maintained, they can claim these rights. And then I have to come over there, and a lot of us will have to come over there, and we serve notification that they have to vacate the property. They have to vacate that space. And if they don't do it within 30 days, then we come back again and we inspect the property. And these people aren't going to leave. They
really
don't care.
So in other words, if somebody owns that property, an individual or, say, the city, and they've essentially abdicated their authority over that area because they don't maintain it and they've not done anything else about other people living there, then those
right.
other people begin to assume the right to stay there? Is that what you're telling me?
That's what you could do here in the state of Illinois.
You know,
Chicago,
you know where you see that and always have is on Lower Wacker Drive. And the city has done such a great job. I've been championing lately the Riverwalk. But when you
right.
use that, you can see over the wall into Lower Wacker Drive. And it's amazing, you know, all the money, all the opportunity for having a nice time that that represents. And literally on the other side of a half wall, at least one point, is a tent city. And,
right.
you know, big picture, we shouldn't wall the problem off. But that's
no.
that's not the point here. They should not be living down there.
No, but you also asked another question, which was, why don't they want to go for help? Why don't they want to go to Teen Challenge? Why don't they want to get the help? A lot of these people have been incarcerated. They don't want to be in enclosed structures. They want to be out. They want freedom. They want to be together. They want to be with each other. Some people just have given up.
Yeah.
They need help. So the city needs to, like the last caller said, the city did drop the ball. I wish the city would refocus some of their energy to help these homeless people to get back on their feet. You talk to these people. You help feed them when you can. And a lot of them are generous. Unfortunately, you also have a lot of people, John, that go down there. That's their job, is to milk money from people and to look like they're homeless and to pretend they're homeless. And I've spoken to these people where they said, yeah, I got a cell phone, I got a wife and kids, I make $400 a day tax-free. And
I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I hear those kind of stories, Paul. I cannot believe those.
I would love to show you. I can give you the names of two of them that see me. I've seen them four times already in the last 6 months, and it's the same story. You're a big guy. You used to play football, didn't you? Hey, you used to be a football coach. Yeah, and I would talk to these people all the time. They're down there. They're doing it. It is the craziest thing. There's not
all right.
a lot.
I'm out of time.
Do it, man.
Really interesting. Paul, thanks for the call.
Take care, John.
Yep, glad you're listening. I got time for one more call. Actually, I don't have time for one more call, but I'm going to do it anyway. Hey, Sue, you're on the air. What did you want to say?
Hi, I just want to say I am a city resident. I'm a docent in the park in Lurie Garden. And I feel like I did once last year think that I could go down Columbus
yeah.
and just keep going north. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it, and I ended up in this encampment. And even though I feel like I'm really confident, I'm a city person, I felt really intimidated because once you get a group of people that starts growing and getting empowered, it's their space and not public space.
Yeah, that's well put. I have friends who are just talking about that very trek the other day, and they live in a high rise south of the loop, and they come into the city or they come north all the time, and she doesn't want to use that route anymore because it just doesn't feel safe. Thanks for the phone call. This is John Williams. You're listening to WGN Radio. Lots and lots and lots of texts about Mark Brown's piece today. Lakeshore Drive bridge work threatens homeless camps. And we will pick this up on another day. In our studio now is the author of I'm Judging You, the Do Better Manual. Levi Ajayi is here. She is the author of not only that, but she does a blog, Awesomely Levi. I was reading it today. Maybe you've read it before, too. She's a bit of the internet sensation, and she's been doing this for like 13 years, which, by the way, is older than the internet. So it's it's pretty remarkable what this Chicagoan is all about. And a UIC alum, too, right?
U of I, Illinois.
Oh, U of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana.
Yeah, Champaign-Urbana.
It says UIC here, and I'm thinking, oh.
UIUC.
Oh, that's right. In fact, I saw you in New York when you visited with the people at Google, and
mm-hmm.
they were talking to you a little bit about how you went to the University of Illinois, a very proud computer school and all
yes.
of that. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about yourself. You're a techie. You're a blogger. You're an author. You're a speaker. You're a positive person, right?
Yeah. I am the professional truth teller.
What do you put on your tax form?
My tax form says writer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just simply says writer.
And that pays the bills?
Yeah, I mean, everything I do, I'm basically in three different places at once. So I'm in pop culture space, I'm in activism space, and I'm in tech. So between all of that and speaking and writing, yep, pays my bills.
Yeah, it's funny because I've always worked for companies mm-hmm. that then write me a check. And then there are people like you who sort of, it seems like you're not working for anybody but yourself,
right.
but you've got all of these revenue streams coming in and
right.
you can make a living if you're good at it.
Right.
The problem is a lot of people are good at blogging or, you know, tweeting funny stuff or or clever stuff, but that really doesn't pay any money, you know?
No, you have to start thinking about yourself beyond the art and think of yourself as a business also. So, you know, writing, for me, I love writing, but I also need to understand that writing can pay my bills because I know that my art has value.
So it's where do you post it or how do you monetize it in that case?
Right, monetizing your work. So I've been blogging for 14 years, and for the probably the first 7 years, I didn't make any money just because I didn't think writing was even an option for a career. And as I started writing and people started reading it, people wanted to pay me for it. And my audience was growing and brands were like, hey, we want access to your audience, so let's work together.
So how does that work? Give me an example.
Example is, for example, I was a brand ambassador for Hallmark, their shoebox cards, which is their humor arm. So they were doing a relaunch. So my audience loves anything funny and smart. So it really aligned well. So for 6 months, I talked about shoebox and wove it organically into my content. So it's not it's not like, hey, go buy shoebox cards. It's me using their cards
right.
in my work.
What's your obligation to out yourself to your audience when you're doing that?
Oh, I have to be transparent. You know, it's really important to always be transparent and say, hey, I am being compensated for this. However, all opinions are still mine.
So, okay, so what if you didn't like one of the shoebox cards?
Then I wasn't going to use it. I always say I retain 100% editorial control no matter who is paying me and what they're paying me.
Right, but would you say if you thought the whole line was no good or if something happened that would cause you to feel the need to honestly express a negative opinion,
mm-hmm.
would you have expressed it while knowing that they're paying you for that?
Yeah, it's actually in my contracts that like I'm not muzzled from being this truth teller.
So they can't cut you off.
No.
At least they'd have to pay the contract out.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, and a lot of times brands come to me because my audience trusts me. And that integrity is why they pay attention to the things I say. So it's very much tied to what I do that I have to be honest about.
That's a very interesting thing that's happening in social media spaces, not just for bloggers, but I was reading, I think it was Time or whatever Newsweek's website is. Is it Newsweek.com?
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a magazine website, and it dawned on me that I was reading paid content. And it wasn't clear to me as I was doing that. You know, sometimes they don't use real big letters to say paid content or whatever the
yeah.
phrase is,
yeah.
that, you know, a partnered content or something mm-hmm. like that. And I go, oh, this is a very interesting article. And it was. Actually, the content was good, but it was also branded. And
right.
and then I felt a little duped about by that whole process,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. See, that's why you have to be transparent. Because it's really easy to just tell people, hey, yes, I am getting paid for this. However, I wouldn't say this if I didn't mean it.
Yeah. And you know what? We run into that sort of thing here. For instance, if I do a commercial for MyPillows,
mm-hmm.
MyPillows, they make great pillows.
Right.
Right now, if you buy one, you get three more for the same price.
Right.
And it includes free shipping. And they're really terrific pillows. They pay us to say stuff like that. But
right.
it's also true.
Right.
And I personally endorse the products I advertise
mm-hmm.
and if when they're paying me for 60 seconds, if there's something that is not great about the product, I'm not going to say that. But I'm also not going to say something that isn't true.
Exactly.
For instance, if the pillows were lousy, I wouldn't say they were great.
Right.
You know, or if they had lumps, I wouldn't say they're lump free. So I'll tell the truth, at least in that 60 seconds that they're paying me to say. And it's clear that it's a commercial, too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, with writers and blogging, it was basically new frontier. Everyone's learning at the same time. But I think the most important part is that transparency.
So then your book is titled I'm Judging You, The Do
Yes.
Better Manual. And then you break it down into four different sort of categories, life, social media, fame, things like that. What's your sort of MO? What are you saying to people?
What I'm saying to people is we're all ridiculous and there's ways for us to do better every single day. And I'm in my humor, in my work, in my tech stuff, I'm always committed to figure out how to make the world better than I found it. So this book is essentially turning the mirror on all of us and saying, look, I'm judging me too. I'm not
right.
just judging you. And here's how we can all basically be a little bit better people.
Give me an example of that.
Example. So when we're in the room and somebody's saying something hateful about another group that we don't belong in, a lot of times we just shake it off and say, you know what? I didn't laugh, so I did enough. What we need to do is, in that space, say, you know what? That is not okay in my presence, and not give it air.
Something that Senator Sasse could have said to Bill Maher. Bill Maher makes the end joke, and everybody laughs, and Sasse is sitting there, and you could tell he was uncomfortable with it.
Right.
But he didn't know if his silence was enough, which is what he used, or should he have called Maher out on the spot?
He should have called Maher out on the spot.
And he says that now, but it was real time, too. Yeah. It's real time with Bill Maher, so it's like, now he's like, ah, crap, I dropped the ball on that. And I'm not beating Sasse up about that omission, right?
I think we all do that. You know what I'm saying? There's so many times in our lives when we're like, ah, should have said something.
Right.
So
hoping, all the time.
All the time, right? So I'm hoping, I'm encouraging people like in these moments to be like, you know what? I'm going to say something as opposed to beat myself up later.
But a lot of us don't want to be the super righteous, judgmental guy.
Right.
Who in fact, on the way home, may be saying to himself, oh, crap, I shouldn't have said that. I was way too judgmental. I was way too preachy, blah, blah, blah.
But wasn't the person who made that statement being judgy by making that hateful statement?
Right, because there is the assumption that we're all going to think this is funny, and I don't. I'm not in that group.
Exactly. And in that time, it is your job to say, you know what? When I am in this room, you can't make those jokes.
So then how did you judge Kathy Griffin's?
I judged Kathy Griffin's because she went a step farther than she should have gone. However, what's interesting is the people who are, you know, lambasting Kathy Griffin really didn't say much when the same images existed about President Barack Obama when he was in office. Like, those images were prolific. They were everywhere.
What images?
Of, like, him being lynched, or, like, literally people photoshopped images of him dead. And Kathy might have been high profile.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's the difference, isn't it?
That's the difference, right? But there's like the Ted Nugent. Ted Nugent who made very crazy statements about the president. So we all have to start figuring out what we are standing up for, who we're standing up for.
But is Facebook how we're supposed to do that? Are we all supposed to be judging your word and attacking and fixing everybody with screeds on Facebook?
Not necessarily. Sometimes I think the ones that matter is when we're face to face at the dinner table, when our uncle says something racist or homophobic and we just let it pass. Those are the times that matter the most, more than Facebook, because we're face-to-face to these people.
You're a big tech person. I mean, you write about technology. How many black women are in the tech sector and writing critically about it?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, there's some. I don't know how many, but not enough. And if there are a lot, we just don't get the platform that others do.
Yeah.
So we don't get the access to, like, a Mashable. Like, there aren't a lot of ways to get access to these websites that have these massive platforms.
What do you make of the new Apple build?
Which one?
Well, the one that they just launched yesterday, their version of Alexa and the Mac.
Oh, HomePod?
HomePod, yeah.
HomePod is fascinating. I think I would just rather stick with Alexa for now. And Amazon has Echo.
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out what makes it different from those two.
So what I hear is the fidelity is better because it's Apple. So it'll sound better if you're using it to play music. And the processing is better, too, because it's Apple. So it's smarter and it sounds better, they say. You know what my problem is, though?
What?
I don't like talking to machines that pretend they're human beings.
It's creepy, right?
I was on the phone the other day, and I was talking to, it was like, who was it? It was, it might have been Comcast.
Okay.
So I'm dealing with Comcast, and it said, you know, is this for home or business? And I say, home. And so then, I'm talking to this phone, and then you hear this, like, there's a person there hitting the keyboard, dialing up my account.
Wow.
And they know that I know that that's not a person, but they've determined that my hearing that audio cue of somebody clicking away on a keyboard will make me feel like, oh boy, Comcast is really working on it now. It's stupid. It's not a person.
You know,
it's just
I
a
love
sound effect.
Technology, but I feel like technology has diminishing returns after a certain point. Like calling Comcast. I had to call Comcast 2 weeks ago, and I wanted to bang my head against the table.
We should have a support group. Hi, my name is John. It's been 6 weeks since hi, John. How are you doing?
It is so frustrating. I'm just like, can I just talk to a human? And it's the machines don't really understand us like we think they should.
I know.
So it's just like, I just want to talk to a human.
I know. And so then they gave me the options. Tell us what you're interested. You could say service or tech support. And so my producer will vouch for me. Sometimes I'll say, want to throw computer out window. you know, very clearly to see, oh, I understand you want to throw the computer out the window. That should be an option they recognize,
seriously,
right? I want
seriously
to flush my browser down the toilet.
You know what I do sometimes? I just press zero repeatedly.
Yes, yes, yes. There. The tech blogger has now given us the most useful piece of information.
Yes.
Just start pounding zero.
Just pound zero until it's like, fine, fine, fine. Here's a human.
You're speaking at the Harold Washington Library for LitFest.
Yes.
I want you to sort of preview a highlight for me in a minute. It's 150. This is WGN. We preview the must-see TV that will be the Comey testimony and the Rosenstein testimony. Those hearings will take place tomorrow, Wednesday and Thursday. ABC runs down what to expect in just a couple of minutes. Lovie Ajayi. Did I say your name correctly, Lovie?
Ajayi.
Ajayi.
Yeah.
You make it sound simple. It's not.
It is. It totally
Have
is.
Have you thought about going with Williams? It would be so much easier.
No.
Lovie Ajayi is here, and her book is I'm Judging You, The Do Better Manual. She's going to be speaking, and oh, do you actually read from your book, too?
I might do a little reading.
Saturday at 1 o'clock, part of LitFest at Harold Washington Library is what I call it.
Yeah.
Is that what you call it?
Yeah.
So what's the highlight? What's the best piece of advice you're going to give or the least judgmental thing you're going to say?
I think the best thing is just like, you know what? Try to figure out how to be less terrible as a person. That is the least, huh?
Well, that bar doesn't seem too high. If each of us got up every day and said, you know, I'm just going to pick one small thing and try and do better at that.
That's it. Yeah. That is it.
I hate to ask, but, you know, you're a tech person. You're a social media person. Awesomely Lovie, by the way, is a really good site. Awesomely
Thank
Lovie
you.
Is yours. I mean, it's not just clever, but it's visually appealing, too, which helps a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What advice would you have for the president about his use of social media?
He needs to log off and somebody needs to change his password so he doesn't have access to it. He's one of those who he breaks every social media rule. He's super temperamental on there all the time, really emotional all the time, really just aggressive and abrasive. So he's like the guy you say do opposite of what he's doing.
Well, you shouldn't troll the mayor of a major city who's trying to deal with a terrorism crisis.
I mean, come on. How is that not the most basic thing to know? How about you show compassion in this time of need? And the mayor of London has been nothing but really classy, graceful.
And the mayor of London is, as I've been reading it, has not really engaged. So when Donald Trump doubled down and called his policies pathetic, it wasn't because the mayor of London said, no, you're pathetic, but Donald Trump decided to layer on. I thought that's why Ivanka was there. I thought that Ivanka was going to be the one going, Dad, give me that thing. Give it here right
now. Everyone thought
that. Give it to me now. Put it in the drawer.
Everyone thought that, but everyone was wrong.
Yeah, I know.
Huge, massively wrong. We were all just like, how could we be so wrong?
Yeah, no kidding.
The whole thing is just like, ugh.
You're in Chicago. You travel, obviously, but you're living, writing, and working out of here all the time. Huh?
I love Chicago. Chicago, I go everywhere in the world, and I'm always happy to come back home.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you coming into our studio.
Indeed.
It's the first time I've met you in person.
Yeah.
Have you been in the studio before?
I have, a couple of times.
Yeah, you need to be here more often. It's
anytime
nice to meet you,
Anytime you want
Lovie.
Me, John, anytime.
I'm Judging You, the Do Better Manual, and she's Saturday at the Harold Washington Library at 1 o'clock. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, don't forget the blog, awesomelylovie.com.
Can I spell it? The Lovie?
Yeah, do that.
Lovie. And that's also my username across all of social media.
So if you're following her on Twitter and stuff like that. She's not a big Instagrammer, so don't waste a lot of time there.
Not true.
No, wait. Or is it, what's
Snapchat.
Snapchat.
Snapchat is
Snapchat.
What I don't do because I just find it to be a bit obnoxious.
Is it possible that you're too old for Snapchat?
I feel like I am too old for
How
Snapchat.
How old are you?
I'm 32.
Oh, my God, you're too old for Snapchat. And I've had somebody explain it. I have Snapchat on my phone. Just to remind me that I'm not as old as people want to think, that I have no idea what to do with it.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
It's 2:08. We're here till 3. Just a little tiny show we do from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue.
Lord have mercy.
This is John Williams. Remember, I'm on Saturdays, too, from 10 a.m. until noon. I think on Saturday we'll talk about the piece also in the Sun-Times today. I thought it was pretty good. Sue Anaveros wrote about wedding dances. Are you a fan of, like, has Has this ship sailed, or do we still love it when wedding couples and wedding parties do special entry dances? You know, those videos went viral and everybody loved them. Oh, my God, here comes the bride and groom.
If it's done really well, you got to have a good one.
Yeah, I think the bar is pretty high these days because otherwise it's... Well, so anyway, she wrote a piece about it, and we'll talk a little bit about that. My son's getting married this fall, so we're, as a family, sort of in the throes right now of all things wedding, all things reception, all things save the date. And it's a whole new wild west out there for wedding planning, let me tell you. One last quick text before we go to our guest regarding the Maher debacle. We were visiting with our guest a moment ago about Bill Maher putting Ben Sasse on the spot. Or did Ben Sasse sort of lay the bait himself? Regarding the Maher debacle, John, I have sympathy for Senator Sasse because I could tell by the look on his face he was utterly shocked and uncomfortable. I don't think I would have been quick enough in my thinking to say anything. I have been in that position before, and I'm always so shocked when someone says something that outrageous, and I don't know what to say. He was on live TV, which made it worse. The responsibility is on Maher for putting his guest in such a horrible position. It's 2:10, so tomorrow and Thursday will be big dates. The Rosenstein testimony, the assistant attorney general, and then you've got Bill Comey's testimony before Congress on Thursday. I said Bill Comey, it's James Comey. Talk a little bit about this. Now is Serena Marshall, the Washington correspondent for ABC News. Serena, welcome back. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good. How are you?
Good. People are literally comparing this to, I don't know, the OJ trial or the Nixon impeachment hearings. As in terms of everybody wondering what's going to be said, this is a big week, isn't it?
It is a big week up here on Capitol Hill. And, of course, it starts tomorrow. There is a Senate intelligence hearing on FISA. Now, that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That may sound familiar because when we talk about reports of unmasking, specifically around those Trump campaign aides who were caught up in foreign surveillance, this is the act that allows that to happen. It basically allows intelligence officials to monitor communications of foreign targets. And then in that process, Americans get caught up in that. And then when they are unmasked by security officials to understand the context of that communication. And that is what tomorrow is going to focus on before we get to the Jim Comey testimony on Thursday.
So the FBI, nobody is saying that the FBI, the CIA, anybody like that, was targeting the Trump campaign per se. Rather, they were listening to the people they might normally, in the course of their business, Russians here. And lo and behold, they were hearing what appeared to be references to the Trump team or Trump team voices. Is that what we think happened?
Exactly. That's what we've heard before testified on Capitol Hill. Tomorrow, you're going to have the director of national intelligence, the acting director for the FBI, the National Security Agency director, and Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general at the Department of Justice, all up here to talk about how that act allows Americans to be caught up in the surveillance, because that act actually expires at the end of this year, and Congress will have to reauthorize it. But it does allow Americans to get caught up in that foreign surveillance. And when they're caught up in it, intelligence officials will ask to do what is called quote-unquote unmasking. We've heard a lot about that term. That is so that the intelligence officials can understand the context of those conversations.
So what does unmasking involve?
It basically requests a high-level intelligence official, because normally these FISA warrants have to go through a court. They have to go to a judge, say, you know, we want to have foreign intelligence on this person. And then once they have that intelligence and they have those conversations with, for example, an ambassador or somebody from overseas, they can say, well, this conversation is very questionable, but in order to understand the full scope of it, we need to know who exactly they're talking to. So they'll go back to the intelligence agency. For example, the National Security Council might go back to the FBI or the CIA and say, I need to know who they were talking to in order to understand the full scope of this conversation, if this is something we need to be worried about or if this is just normal operations.
Well, what if it's something in between? That is, there was nothing compromising U.S. safety, but it did look like the Trump Organization was having inappropriate, that's my word, conversations with the Russians. What if it's not so clear?
Well, that is why they might need to unmask something, right? So under the FISA, that act, if federal agencies monitor digital communications of foreigners located overseas, so you might have a Russian official, a German official, Chinese official overseas, and they are being monitored. It's typical that the U.S. government does that, right? That's not atypical. And what happens is they'll be monitoring that conversation and hear an American on that conversation, and they know they're talking to an American either through the phone line or, you know, other tracking that they have. And they'll say, this is a very weird conversation. We need to know who they're talking to in order to get the full scope of that conversation. And that's when they'll make that request to unmask the person. So you can expect tomorrow a lot of the senators to focus around how that works, how Americans get caught up in it, and how Americans' data might be collected or stored, which for some raises critical privacy and civil liberties issues, which is one of the things we're definitely going to be hearing about tomorrow.
Well, I think we've had that conversation before, not that it's over, but I'm less interested in the process and more in the content myself. However they got it, whatever means they used, what did it say? For instance, let me ask you this, Serena. Do transcripts exist? Will we ever hear the audio tape that we're talking about?
Well, those are, you know, classified documents, so that'll have to be coming out in some form of the Russia investigation if they decided to make those tapes public. Obviously, since it does the security agencies that oversee these FISA warrants, that would have to come from those agencies. Now, it is a possibility, let's say Mueller, the special counsel overseeing the Russia investigation, when all of this comes out later, and they bring any charges against anybody, we could see tapes of that sort. But that is a big if, and it's up to those intelligence agencies.
What should the Trump administration be worried about relative to all of this?
I think the question Democrats are asking is, if campaign officials were wrapped up in this foreign surveillance, which according to intelligence officials, they said some were because they were caught up in these FISA communications, then it's the intent and if they were knowingly communicating with Russian officials, because that's the other thing. We've heard former intelligence officials testify that either knowingly or unknowingly, wittingly or unwittingly, were they just part of this conversation and didn't know that they were talking to a Russian agent, or were they having these conversations with intent? And that is what I think the senators really want to get at the core of this.
Well, that may be part of Wednesday's testimony, but I think people are more also interested in Thursday's testimony when the former FBI director talks. Are they going to ask him, did you literally say to the president three separate times that you're not under investigation?
Well, and John, we actually have some exclusive ABC reporting on this where a source familiar with Comey's thinking has told us that Comey will stop short of saying President Trump obstructed justice in the Flynn probe, but he will say he was uncomfortable with some of the conversation, which is what led him to write those memos that we kept hearing about. This source telling us he's not going to Congress to make accusations about the president's intent. Instead, he's there to share his concerns.
Still, I wonder if three separate times Comey told Trump that he's not under investigation. That's what the president says.
Yes, that is what the president said. And again, this source telling us he will dispute the president on that claim. He will stop short of saying he obstructed justice. But when it comes to that claim, he told the president he was not under investigation. He will dispute that.
He will dispute that. And it's not his job to say whether or not that's obstruction of justice anyway. To be honest with you, I don't think I need him to say that. We'll let the Senate or another court decide that, right?
Well, and Comey is a lawmaker. He was the deputy attorney general under President Bush. He ran the FBI, obviously. And so he knows as a legal mind what he should and shouldn't say. And so he's not going to make claims about somebody else's thinking. Instead, he's going to say how I felt, what I think, and what was said to me, point blank, what I know.
What else maybe would Comey say that would lead somebody else to draw that conclusion?
Well, all we know from these conversations is that he will stop short of saying the president obstructed justice in the Flynn probe, but he'll say he was uncomfortable with what the president asked him about the, according to that memo Comey wrote, he said the president told him, I hope you can see your way clear of letting this go to letting Flynn go. And Comey will testify that he felt uncomfortable, that made him uneasy.
Right.
And then that could lead others to draw conclusions.
Well, are those facts in dispute? Is it agreed upon that the president dismissed the vice president? Who else was in that room when they were having dinner on Valentine's Day? It was the
or well,
the
meeting. Vice President and the Attorney General were
Attorney
asked
General.
To leave when some of
right.
this some of these conversations happened. So, from what we know so far, these conversations was had in private.
Okay, but yeah, but that's what I'm wondering is the telling of that story too. They're there, and then the President turns to the Attorney General and the Vice President says, "I need you guys to leave," and then he turns to Comey. And he says that I need you to kind of look the other way or help me out on this. Are those facts in dispute, or does everybody agree that, in fact, that's what happened?
Well, we only know from what sources have told us about that memo that Comey wrote, what was said. And Comey was known for taking copious amounts of notes, known for documenting everything. That's something that many people familiar with him have said he does. And so he wrote down, according to those who have seen the memo, quote, "I hope you can see your way to letting this go, to letting Flynn go, and that also he is a good guy. I hope you can let this go."
Okay, maybe it's not his job to judge whether or not that's obstruction of justice, that or the other statement, but shouldn't he have brought this up right away? Shouldn't he have said something about it sooner?
Well, and that's what some people have questioned previously in some of these hearings. And according to, again, those familiar with with former director thinking, have said that he didn't want to impede the Russia investigation. So he did share it with some close to him, but not those overseeing the Russia investigation, because he didn't want it to impede their thinking and have them draw conclusions from things that they didn't come to on their own.
To these two points that we're speaking about, how likely is it that he'll be forthright? Is it possible that he'll just say, as they always do, "I can't comment on an ongoing investigation"?
Well, there is going to be some of that, because remember, before he was asked to testify, he said no, and then they asked him again, this time in a public hearing, and then he delayed his response because he wanted to consult with Special Counsel Mueller before he came forward. And so there is certain elements that we know he's going to have to say, "I can't comment on that, it's an ongoing investigation," or "I'm not read into that because it's the ongoing investigation, so my knowledge ends when I was fired." But at the same time, Comey testified publicly in 2007, and it was the same kind of situation. He first denied it because he wanted a public hearing. He wanted to make sure there was no misconstruing what he said. And so if you base his upcoming testimony on how he was in the past, he was very forthright, very honest, and he said what he felt, and he didn't try to draw conclusions about what other people thought.
Does Comey have credibility on this? If it becomes a he said, I wonder how Republicans, Democrats, the public at large will sort of judge his testimony.
Well, I mean, it's definitely caused some splits politically, right? You have the Republicans versus the Democrats. But the Senate Intelligence Committee has done a very good job of maintaining a joint, united front when it comes to all of this. They're really trying to be a voice of reason in it all. And Director Comey, while he has come under a lot of scrutiny in the past year, investigation into Russia and obviously comments he made on the Clinton emails and everything. But before that, he was known as a very level-headed man who had great respect across the political spectrum on Capitol Hill. Remember, he served as deputy attorney general under the Bush administration. He wasn't political. He was a career legal mind. And so it wasn't until the last year that he kind of started taking on these political tinges to his reputation. But overall, those that are familiar with him and know him well and have worked with him had always good things to say before that.
I wonder if the Trump team is planning for the worst case scenario. What's the worst case scenario? Would it be that the president fired Sessions because Sessions was getting too close to the truth?
Comey?
Comey, I guess. Yeah, right. Sessions recused himself. The president sort of said as much that now that he's out of the way, my life is a little easier. I wonder if that's the worst case scenario for the president.
Well, we've heard that the White House is setting up a war room to respond to some of these, the Russia investigation and the claims. And the president has signed or has asked a law firm to represent him outside. Now, when we ask that question at White House briefings, they pivot and say outside counsel. So the White House is trying to separate themselves a little bit from this investigation because they've admitted it's become a roadblock in pushing any policies forward.
Okay, Serena Marshall, Washington correspondent for ABC News. Riveting stuff. Let's continue to follow this and visit again down the road.
Sounds good. Thank you, John.
Serena Marshall with ABC. Busy while it wasn't on the air there. I didn't grab my... here it is. Listen to this quote. "Do you believe in climate change?" Instagram followers of Jonathan Taves read his post the other day. He said, the only lie we tell ourselves is that we are more special than other life forms on this planet. Well, we're not. Even if we weren't responsible for any major climate catastrophes heading our way, shouldn't we still do our part to preserve what we have left? The same way that we shouldn't wait till our bodies break down completely to start doing the right things to stay healthy. Let's not wait until it's too late to do something. I'm not saying I'm perfectly green, but the first step is to keep an open mind. That's from a hockey player. So he's not on board the Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. He posted that with some pictures, I guess, of him hiking in Hawaii, walking a trail. There was another story in the paper today that said that 58% of us, 6 out of 10, do not like the American decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. 28% are for it. So 58-28 is the margin. And then it's like you might imagine, more Republicans than not support the president on this. More, I think this is worth noting, 60-some percent of Republicans agree with what the president did. And then a very small percentage, it's like 9% of Democrats agree with what the president did. And this is John Williams. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis are in these studios in about 25 minutes. Let's take some time to visit with Jeremy McCarter. He's got a book out. You know, we've been featuring a lot of the authors that were going to be appearing at LitFest or are. I mean, everything from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to maybe names in literature you more know, although this isn't Jabbar's first book either. But now, Young Radicals in the War for American Ideals is a book written by the, it says here on the cover, number one New York Times bestselling co-author of Hamilton the Revolution, Jeremy McCarter is here. He's a Chicagoan, and he's in our studio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Boy, you got to love that as sort of a tagline, don't you? That'll get you into a lot of places.
Well, I guess we'll find out. You know, the book comes out in a few days in a world not at all like the one I expected it would arrive into, but it's getting close now.
Your book, Young Radicals, this is not a book about today. It's a book about 100 years ago.
Right. It's becoming more of a book about today than I anticipated that it would be. But my original impulse was to tell a story about this fascinating moment of our national story that happened almost exactly 100 years ago.
1913, 1912, 1911, around there.
Yeah, this moment of unbelievable promise when the country was leaping ahead. I got excited about this when I was in college. It felt like our ambitions and our dreams were getting a little small, and we were arguing around the margins about the things that we needed to fix. And I looked at this era when socialism and progressivism and the suffrage movement and modernism were all hitting at the same time, and people just had these vast hopes for what America could become.
What happened to those hopes?
They all got the legs kicked out from under them when the United States went into World War I in 1917. And so what drew me to it, dramas change, right? And so there's this immense change in 1917 when we go from this moment of great hope and anticipation to repression and cynicism. And the people who had been so hopeful 10 years earlier are now coming out the other side as the lost generation.
Well, that's interesting. So how were those hopefuls regarded then as we went into World War I?
They were rabble rousers. They were troublemakers. This was a generation. So I picked these five figures that were I thought were particularly fascinating, and I liked the way that they held together. I thought they could sustain a single story. It's nonfiction, but I still wanted it to be a story. And they had grown up knowing only peace and relative prosperity, and so they were willing to take big chances. You know, when they got to the plate, they took big swings.
Give me an example.
So you have somebody like John Reed, who was a Harvard graduate who was not particularly distinguished when he was there. He went abroad and had a bunch of ugly American adventures. But when he came back, he started getting radicalized. He started identifying more with workers and the way that the economic system of this country was not letting them have the chance to thrive. And so he decides that the way to help people understand what's going on in Paterson, New Jersey, where there's an enormous silk strike, is to stage a pageant where the strikers will come to Madison Square Garden in New York, and 1,000 of them will recreate what they have been doing across the river in Paterson that the press won't cover. And it's this enormous creative breakthrough for the way people can tell their own stories. And it was something that, you know, no one thought was going to work.
What did they demonstrate? What did they do?
they recreated the scenes from the strike. So why they walked out when they wanted an 8-hour day and better conditions. There were the labor leaders' speeches that they had given to rally the workers in Patterson, the same leaders reproduced on stage for the enormous audience in Madison Square Garden.
You know, an ism that I have trouble with these days is nationalism.
Right.
You know, we're Americans. I believe that Americans wear the white hat in the world. I still do. I always will. And I think it's been true in my life and in our history.
Yeah.
That's nationalism. What do we do with that? And is that changing how we regard that?
I think it is. Nationalism is something that we tend to think of as being a relic of the past. But I think what we're seeing these days is that nationalism is something that's programmed deep into us as human beings. We want to feel that we belong to a group and that that group has some dignity. And I think a lot of people have been feeling completely left out from the progress of American society, and they're retaliating. One of the interesting moments of this story I try to tell, there was a social critic named Randolph Bourne. He was an incredible, young, brilliant writer. He was a hunchback. He had a kind of deformed face. He was always an outsider, even among his friends. And what he saw when he looked around in 1916 with World War I raging is that the Germans and the French and the Americans and the Russians weren't fighting each other in America. They were getting along. And what it made him realize is that there is something special about this country. American exceptionalism means, for the first time, as he puts it, we have realized the hope of the nations, which is that all of these different kinds of people can find a way to live side by side. And what he wanted to do was articulate a way to get that nationalistic feeling, but attach it to something that would include everybody.
Hmm. How are we doing on that today?
Not great. You know, he articulated this vision of transnational America in 1916. Once the war started in 1917, he never mentioned it again because it's absurd to talk about being a home to all the nations when you're fighting Germany. But, you know, in the last couple of months, when you listen to what people have been saying, listen to the defenses of the travel ban, listen to the arguments that are supposed to back up Make America Great Again, they're all talking about a specific idea of what America is supposed to be. And it was something that used to exist. We're reaching backwards to reclaim some America that we've lost. Bourne's paradox was to say, actually, America's cultural identity is something that we all have to create together. Everybody. You can't reach back. We weren't all here 50 years ago. We're here now. We have to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. So when you were writing the book, I mean, and then you've been working on this book for six, 7 years, right?
6 years, yeah.
Okay. So Donald Trump wasn't a candidate 6 years ago. So you were writing this historical piece. And what was your objective? To sort of say, these are people who are hopeful. And it did not work out. They don't win in their lifetimes. World War I happens. The attitude changes. Looking back, were they winners? Did they have a positive influence on this country?
Yeah, I think for sure that they did. I mean, it's an interesting question. I wrestled with it a lot at the end, particularly with everything that was happening in January, which is when I had to let the thing finally go to press. You can't ever really say the last word when someone's fighting for an ideal the way these five were, because it's a relay race. And it started before any of us got here, and it's going to continue after we're gone.
And you're talking about social reform, things like minimum wage, stuff like that. Well, a lot of those things are a lot better now than they were then, right?
Absolutely.
Progress has been made, maybe on their shoulders. But then you're writing this, and then you see the Trump campaign come along, and you got very discouraged, didn't you?
Right. I had my introduction all teed up and ready to go on November 7th, 2016. And then the next night I realized, well, I guess I'm going to have to reframe my book now, because I thought I was telling the story about this chapter in America's progress towards the realization of its ideals and what an immense next step forward that was going to be to elect a woman president finally. And then it turns out I'm telling a different kind of story, which is the exact phenomenon that I had just spent 6 years writing about. I can't tell you how insane it was to feel like I have just been writing about this feeling and now I am feeling it myself, which is, I have had it all wrong. I thought I understood this country and the direction in which it was moving. The optimism that I was writing about, I felt in the Obama years. And now suddenly, did I have this completely backwards? And that's what we're all grappling with now.
Is the mistake we make vilifying the people who voted for Trump then? I mean, because really, they don't know you. They're not mad at you. Right. They're simply saying, It wasn't all so rosy. It was so screwed up for us, or we are so disenchanted with this America that we're going to vote for Donald Trump.
Right.
That's, I think, you know, we need to heed that message.
Right. I think it's a terrible mistake to demonize the people who voted for Donald Trump. I think people cast their votes for lots of different reasons, and that part of the problem that got us into this is trying to paint everybody with the same brush. I mean, even look, in my era, it's not like suddenly a bad guy came along and then everything falls apart. Woodrow Wilson was the president that decided to fight Germany in 1917. This wasn't some sort of reactionary warmonger. I mean, he did it for idealistic reasons, which is one of the reasons why then at the end, everyone is so disillusioned. And, you know, for now, you know, the Trump era, whatever the set of reasons that led people to vote for him, I still think now it's the old challenge. It's, can we come together and find a way to defend the same things that the Young Radicals were trying to defend?
And the Young Radicals is the title of your book, and the War for American Ideals, set not in 2017 or 2016, but set almost exactly 100 years ago. I don't know if history repeats itself as a good thing or a bad thing here, but I'm still optimistic. I mean, if we are like, I had this conversation with my sons the other night, and they didn't give me a pass on it, but I said none of us knew how bad it would be. So if I didn't vote for Donald Trump, I was guessing that a Trump presidency would be a bad thing. It's worse than I imagined. The people who did vote for Donald Trump, it's worse than they imagined it was going to be. They thought he might be a good president, or maybe he'll be a marginal president, but he won't be wackadoodle. Turns out he's wackadoodle. They could not have known how bad it would be. My kids didn't give me that. But that's where I am on this one. Right. And I'm still optimistic that we're going to figure this out and we will still be the country of promise that we've always been.
Right.
Do you share that?
I do. I mean, I think about hope a lot. And I can't remember now where I encountered this in the research. I wish I could. I got to look this up. But someone said that hope isn't optimism. It's not thinking that things are going to turn out for the best. Hope only has meaning if it's your impulse to work to make it better. That's the difference. It's hope expresses itself in action to try to bring about the thing that you want to see. And so I'm a hopeful person. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, except having just written about this immense like rise and fall of American prospects. I am concerned about the way the arrows are pointing, but I also know that if we got through 1919 and the race riots and the Red Scare and the arrival of J. Edgar Hoover in an unsuspecting world, we'll get through what's coming.
Every now and then I think about that. Like, think about the 1960s when we were assassinating, you know, attorneys general, presidents, and civil rights leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know how we would handle that today. We've been through some crazy times before. Before I let you go, have you seen the Chicago cast of Hamilton?
I have seen the Chicago cast.
How many
incredible times?
Three,
yeah. I think.
And still loving it?
Still loving it. I was very blessed to get to spend the same 6 years I worked on Young Radicals around Hamilton. And the most exciting thing about it is that it's alive. The show is alive. So they've replaced all of the people. It's none of the original actors in Chicago. And it's the same but different. It's like a living thing is alive. And it changes night to night, and it's beautiful.
Jeremy, thanks for coming into our studio. You live in Chicago, right?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Come to our studio more often. Visit with us again.
I'd love to.
It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
By the way, you're appearing at LitFest, right?
That's right.
Do you know offhand when and where you're going to be?
I do. I will be talking about Young Radicals with the great Alexander Heyman on Sunday morning, the 11th at 11 a.m.
Okay, the book is titled Young Radicals, Jeremy McCarter. It's 2:50. This is WGN. So we were just talking about the difference between what happened and when you wrote your book about these young radicals, idealistic people living in a time of prosperity, and then all of a sudden everything goes to the pooper because World War I is looming, and that idealism and hope at least dies for a while. And you liken that in your book to what's happening now, even though when you were writing the book, you did not know how that was going to end.
Right.
I said to you off the air on your way out the door, Jeremy, I said, don't you think maybe social media will save us from some of our worst impulses? I know the president can use it and the government can spy on us with social media tools, but I don't know. It seems to me to be a very democratic, small d tool that the people have now that they didn't have when you were writing. And then you started to say what?
Well, that social media is a way of riling people up. and the American people got really, really riled up in 1917. The United States went into war on a scale it had never experienced before. The Committee on Public Information, which was the propaganda arm of the federal government, riled people up even more. And then you start seeing really atrocious things start to happen. There are these vigilante groups that are semi-sanctioned by the Department of Justice. They're going out and doing terrible things to their citizens.
Americans spying on Americans.
Yes, so many, in fact, that the Bureau of Investigation at the Justice Department couldn't process the tips they were getting fast enough because there were thousands of them coming in every day. You have German shopkeepers getting tarred and feathered. There are race riots. There's the Red Scare, which is a very industrious J. Edgar Hoover relying on this network he has built of people informing on their neighbors. It's not to say that any of this is going to happen again, but what it is to say is I am watching very carefully not the specific actors doing specific things, but the climate in which they're doing it.
I sense more pushback, though. I don't see the momentum going in the direction you're describing. I see people becoming aware of whatever the latest version of that is and pushing back.
Right. Well, John, that's it. It's peacetime. I mean, if there's an attack, if the thing that happened in London over the weekend were to happen in Times Square or right here, we're looking out on Michigan Avenue, then how far can you push people to start informing on their neighbors? And I want to think that, as you said, I mean, this is really a test of having spent these years around Hamilton. This is a test of the system that those guys created in the 18th century. They built in all these safeguards. They tried to defend the country against a tyrant taking over, against people who are going to tear the system apart from within. I think the system is going to hold. I think that we're not going to go back to the repression of 1919. I also think that this is the best it's going to be because we haven't been attacked. It's not wartime. There isn't any sort of rallying to the flag about Americans dying that way. And if that holds, I'm confident.
It's a hell of a test, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the worst we've faced since the Civil War.
Well, on that happy note, why don't you leave?
Yeah.
I'm so glad I invited you back. Seriously, the book is called Young Radicals, and it's great history. It's also, as you can tell, really relevant these days from Jeremy McCarter. He is the co-author of Hamilton, The Revolution. He wrote that with Lin-Manuel Miranda. That was on the New York Times bestseller list. How long before this one gets there, too? He's speaking on Sunday, right?
Sunday.
At
11 a.m., Printer's Row, Alexander Heyman.
Thanks for coming into the studio.
It's 2:57.
Ro and Anna will, too. That's next. Ro Khan.
Present.
Here,
Anna DeVlantis.
Also present.
What's going on, campers?
Well,
that's a big day today.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Very, very, very big day.
You guys always say that.
No. This is special, John.
Really?
Truly.
I mean, what's the highlight, Anna, that you're referring to?
Well, one of the things, we're celebrating the birthday of someone very special today, John.
The L?
Other than the L, being
Bjorn
125
Borg.
Years.
Bjorn Borg is today, I believe, and we would like to, I remember
Bjorn.
Tennis great Bjorn Borg.
Wooden racket, Bjorn Borg.
Yeah.
Yeah, famous birthdays today. Someone we all know.
And we have, and the L. Which I think is 125 years young today.
Yeah.
And I believe I have been on track and maybe in cars that are 125 years old.
I think, like, and I've been near trestles that I think are 125.
Without question.
More
that's
disturbing.
The scary thing, yeah.
Well, Lake Street, right? I mean, I've worked under Lake Street, under that L for, three decades.
Yeah.
And when the train goes by on that, you're like, I like especially the turn at Lake and Wabash, where sometimes the train forgets to turn and just goes straight over the side.
Right.
I look at some of the rest and I think, is everybody else seeing this?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that like
is
a red flag?
Is everyone comfy with this? Are we okay? Because
whose
it
job
doesn't
is
sound
it
right.
To not be comfy with this because that person needs to see this. All right, kids, we'll have a really outstanding program.
All right. Plus, we'll debut Rahm Emanuel's new podcast today. We're going to give it a little broadcast spin. Yep. He really has his own podcast.
I really don't want to hear that.
Isn't it amazing? Everybody has their own podcast. You don't have to. All you need to do is you need $99 and you can have your own podcast.
It's sort of like Mike Pence had a syndicated radio show. And I think, God bless you, but how did Mike Pence have a syndicated radio show?
He had a big syndicated radio show. He didn't have a small. He was actually a talk show host way before, like a one of
legitimate.
Us talk show hosts.
Did you hear it?
Before he was a congressman.
Did you hear it? And was it as flat as he is?
You know how he does that thing where he's constantly in a moment of great sincerity.
Yes,
furrowed
yes.
brow. Everything is sincere.
He did that yesterday when he announced that we are still going to stand behind the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
It was really dramatic.
Yes, he's very. That's what he is. That's the as a talk show host. That's how he performed. Well, everything is very earnest.
You guys, have a great show.
Thank you, John. John.